Jared Phelps is coming off Tommy John surgery.
No problem.
I always joke, the first two pro clients I had reached the big leagues, and it's been downhill since then.
Did both guys and stuff have a capital in that sentence?
No, just stuff.
And welcome to Artificial Turf Wars, episode number 127. We're just limbering up to play all around the diamond in honor of a certain Team Canada shortstop. I'm your host, Greg Wisniewski, and I'm joined by Joshua Howsam. Josh, how's it going?
Good, you?
Good. We have a couple of things to discuss because Russell Martin has waved goodbye to the Rogers Centre, or the Sky Dome, depending on what you prefer, and is back to where it all started for him in Los Angeles. So we're going to have a little look back at his career in Toronto. David Phelps is now a Toronto Blue Jay, and he has a contract loaded with incentive clauses that we're still trying to sort out. Dalton Pompey talked to Sportsnet about how he's looking at next year, and we're kind of wondering about what next year might hold for him. We might talk a little bit about organizational culture. We have an interview with Kyle Bodie of Driveline Basis, because some of his employees are now Blue Jay employees. And then we're going to take your questions, of which you have many about Bryce Harper, I believe, is primarily what you have questions about. And then we're going to look at the depth chart in that context. And I think that about sums up what we're looking at this week. Fair?
Yeah, sounds about right.
All right. So Russell Martin is no longer a Blue Jay, but certainly he left his mark on Toronto. And I believe you have given me an idea that I should play something in honor of Russell. So would you like me to do that now, just so we can remember
this
moment? All right, here we go. Russell, Russell, Russell. Wow.
That was a big moment.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think we haven't had a lot of big moments in the last 2 years. So that's kind of a bit of a time warp, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, jumping back to 2015, which is, that's a while.
When the Blue Jays were relevant and Russell Martin was an offensive force for the Toronto Blue Jays, which is something else that seems like a bit of a time warp. But that was a lot of fun. That was walking off the Yankees?
No, actually, no? It wasn't. It's funny. That moment like has a bit of a interesting connotation to it. People sort of talk about it as the moment that sealed the division for the Jays. And it kind of did. What's weird is the Jays were actually already winning this game 1-0, but he just put it out of reach.
Hmm. He crushed him.
I think it was. But they were up. And then he hit the 3-run bomb.
Off of?
Andrew Bailey.
Where is Andrew Bailey right now?
He's retired. But that was actually the second home run that he hit off Bailey that year, which is kind of interesting. But it was that was the most exciting time ever to be a Blue Jays fan. And I don't think anyone would argue about that. Oh, sorry. Since 1993.
There
the
we
most
are.
Exciting time to be a Blue Jays fan.
Props to the actual World Series winning teams, absolutely. But I think really in the memory of most people listening to this podcast, we're talking about the most exciting time that they can really identify with. And Russell Martin is a big part of that 2015-2016 team, both in the way he handled the pitching staff defensively, his ability at the time to throw out runners was very, very good. So he was a two-way player, and he was Canadian, and significantly, he was worth the money that they were paying him, which was literally the biggest contract the Blue Jays have ever handed out.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's a way to overstate the impact that he had on that team. You mentioned the throwing runners out. He led the league in caught stealing percentage at 44% his first year with the team. Somehow it went to 15 the next year. I don't know how that happened, but, it was just a massive upgrade at catcher. Something, I mean, you know, Deonner Navarro was there before and he had his pluses when it came to working with pitchers, but just wasn't in the same league defensively as Russell Martin was.
Absolutely. And it wasn't in the same league offensively as Russell Martin. I think when the Blue Jays went for that fifth year on the contract for Martin, I mean, there was a hope that he could be the player with the 400 OBP that he was the previous year. But really, what you were focused on, I think, was, are there going to be two really good, solid years, maybe three at the beginning of this contract? And, well, those last 2 years, that's the price you pay for bringing on board a free agent.
Right. I mean, just talking about this now, is there a situation where you would say, you know what, I wish the Blue Jays didn't sign him to that contract, even though, you know, last year for $20 million and this coming year, like, no, right?
No, because you needed a guy with the kind of impact that Russell Martin had in the first 2 years. He was in that window. I mean, we hoped that the window was going to be longer for everybody, right? But he was in the window that he needed to be, and he was productive in that window. That's exactly why you go out and sign a free agent. You do not have any illusions, I don't think, signing a guy to a 5, 6, 7 year contract in baseball, expecting him to be productive in year 6 or 7. That's just the way things are supposed to work. So you really hope that, you know, there isn't a big injury in year 1 and it kind of throws a wrench in the whole thing. And Russell Martin, to his credit, did exactly what you needed from him with the right team at the right time. So I will look back fondly on his time, regardless of the backloaded part of the contract that wasn't a great value.
Yeah, I mean, and even just when talking about that, this past season was just not good for him. I mean, he hit 194. He hit a 338 on base percentage, which was actually the second highest he's had as a Blue Jay. But, you know, the power went away because he wasn't making contact. But even the year before that, you know, he had a 343 on base and a 388 slugging, which for a catcher is excellent.
Yeah, and I think because our expectations were really high in terms of a Russell Martin complete player, I think maybe we got a little down on that. Also, he was a streaky player, if I remember rightly. It took him a long time to get his feet under him in that 2017 season.
Sorry, it's just funny. Speaking of that, Russell Martin started his Blue Jays career by going 1-for-24. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I do, actually. I remember thinking, man, just please impress us eventually, like sooner rather than later. This was on a team that was consistently 500 despite every other metric indicating that they shouldn't be. And then you got this this month worth of catcher who should be a whole lot better than he is. I think there was a lot of that first 4 months of 2015 was, this should be going a whole lot better than it is. And he was the epitome of that.
Especially at the beginning. Yeah, I mean, he was hitting in the 100s until May, which, you know, not what they signed up for, a guy who had hit 290 the year before with a 400 on base percentage or whatever it was.
But, you know, at the end of the year, it all worked out. So, again, we don't really think about that as a problem.
No, and as you just illustrated, he had a huge hit in the most important regular season series for the Jays, you know, in 20 years at that point. And, you know, and his work with guiding the pitching staff and his work on framing pitches was just so key, I think, especially for not just Stroman when he came back, but for Osuna and Sanchez coming out of the bullpen as really young pitchers as well.
I think just as an odd aside, is there is a chance in another universe, another timeline, that we would remember Russell Martin as the guy who allowed the winning run to score because he hit someone's bat throwing the ball back to the pitcher.
And eliminated the Jays from the first postseason series in 20 some odd years. Yeah. Yep. thank God we have a bat flip to remember instead.
So, I mean, Russell Martin was always in the thick of it, wasn't he? I mean, he
sure was. He's the guy who hit the ground ball that turned into the error where Donaldson scored at eliminate Texas the year after.
Yeah. So there's a lot of Russell Martin intense moments in Blue Jays lore, right? Even though he might not be the guy hitting the home run every time, he might not be earning the MVP award, he certainly had a tremendous influence on the team and the culture of the team, I think, in that period of time. So it's also nice that he's Canadian, that when he went to Montreal, it felt like a homecoming for him. So there was some other connection to fans. He wasn't just some other guy who was, you know, sort of some kind of random face until a whole bunch of time went by. He had some real connections to the team and to the country. I think that made it easier to welcome him to the team.
Yeah, Yeah, totally agree. I know this can be weird with these trips to Montreal now.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there's no Michael Saunders. There's no Russell Martin. No Brett Laurie.
No.
who is it? Is there a Canadian on the team at the moment? I'm forgetting.
Well, Dylan Pompey is technically on the 40-man roster, and we'll get to him a bit more later. But
yes, indeed. But there's no no opening day lineup potentially guy who's Canadian. That's been feels like it's been a while since that's been the case.
Well, it's because Russell Martin's been here for 5 years.
Well, yeah, exactly. It started to seem like how many good Canadians can they gather up? But now that's faded a little bit. Is there anything else you want to say? Well, do you want to talk about the fact that that's still the biggest contract that the Blue Jays have ever handed out, as you pointed out to me off air?
Also, Vlad Jr. is Canadian, so yeah.
I think on a technicality, but it's a wonderful technicality.
He was born in Canada.
Yeah, but I don't know this for a fact. Is his mother actually a Canadian citizen, or is he an anchor baby?
Possibly. I don't know the exact details of Vlad Jr.'s family history.
I know Vlad Sr. never got Canadian citizenship.
We can talk about the contract. We should also talk about what they got for him.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there was a return. Obviously, they're paying some of that freight to L.A., which was a given. Basically, the Blue Jays have very clearly been clearing the decks of all older players. So, goodbye, Russell. Sorry about that. What do we know about who they got in return?
Well, so they traded for a middle infielder named Ronnie Brito, who's, he's younger. He's just 19 years old. Yeah, well, he turns 20 in March. And they traded for a pitcher named Andrew Sopko, who turns 25 in the middle of next season. Very different returns between those two. Sopko he's basically, from every scout you hear talk about him, it's like, this is a guy who is your depth starter, spot starter when you need, in AAA, which every team needs those guys. And the Jays, need them more than most people last year. Like Brandon Compton was making starts. But Brito's the opposite. He's the guy with the big upside and the big downside.
The lottery ticket, so to speak.
Yeah, so he was the year the Jays signed Vlad Jr. actually for $3.9 million or $3.96 or whatever it was. Brito got $2 million from the Dodgers. So it wasn't, he was a guy. I love when I say that. And it's like everybody's a guy. But
capital G.
Yeah, capital G-U-Y. but so he was in the Dominican Summer League for his first year, and then he broke his femur, which, that sucks.
Yeah, no kidding.
It's a really hard bone to break because it's enormous. But so he missed almost a full season. And so last year he was a 19-year-old in rookie ball, which is not really what you want to be seeing out of, a guy who you gave $2 million to. But he did really well. So he's got a lot of swing and miss in his game, but also he has power, and depending on who you hear, he could play the middle infield really well. So I think this year will tell us a lot more about him than anything he's done in the past.
Having been injured and having only been in short season ball, I assume that it's tough to come up with a consensus on him at the moment.
Yeah, and part of the problem with that too, and I think it was Kylie McDaniel who pointed this out, he's changed his swing like 6 or 7 times.
He's 19.
And he's only been playing pro ball for a year and a half. So I don't really understand that. But I don't know. I think we'll really see once the Jays get him in their system and start working with him.
All right. We're probably going to talk at great length about over this offseason about contracts and sizes of thereof and lack of size of thereof, because we all know where that's leading in baseball. But Russell Martin was literally a big free agent get where the Blue Jays actually outspent other teams to get him. That's kind of a watershed moment in a different way than some of the other things we've been talking about with Russell.
Yeah, I mean, the Jays have done that in the past, and it always seems to be the same way, too. Like, think of BJ Ryan, AJ Burnett. It's like going that extra year on the contract.
It's all we got.
Sometimes you got to do that, right? If this is the guy you want, then who cares what happens in 2020 or 2019 or whatever, if you're trying to win in 2015.
Yeah, and we'll find out more about that when you start asking questions about Bryce Harper. So,
which you did. Listeners.
All right, let's talk about the other signing. The guy coming in, not the guy going out. David Phelps is. Tell us about David Phelps. What do we need to know?
So, like, it seems to be a trend for the Blue Jays with their acquisitions. David Phelps is coming off Tommy John surgery.
No problem.
Yeah, he had Tommy John surgery last March, so there's a chance he might not be ready for the opening day roster. But unlike, say, Julian Merriweather, David Phelps has been really good in the minors or in the majors recently. He was a mediocre starter, came up with the Yankees, went to the Marlins, but then when he got shifted to the pen, he was, you know, he was lights out. His first year in the bullpen with Miami, he had a 2.28 ERA in, you know, 86 innings with 114 strikeouts. Next year, he had 62 strikeouts in 55. But this is a guy that, if he's healthy, is a power arm. He can get up to the to about 97 in the bullpen, or he averages around that velocity, I should say, when he doesn't throw as hard as the starter, and has the ability to go multiple innings, which if they're trying to use an opener strategy or anything like that, he could be really useful.
So super awesome. We're just hoping he's like the 75% of Tommy John surgery recipients, not the 25% who have all kinds of problems trying to get back.
Yeah. And, you know, that the people tend to think of Tommy John. I think we've talked about this before, but they tend to think of Tommy John as, oh, it's like you're out of year and you come back and you're just as good. And that's not really the case. A long time ago on this podcast, back when we were called the Blue Jays Plus podcast, we had Stefania Bell on and we talked about this very thing. It's not, you know, it's not a magic cure. And guys, some guys don't come back right from it. But, you know, from all accounts, his rehab is going well. So that's encouraging, at least.
Yeah. All right. So that remains to be seen. But what also remains to be seen is if it does go well for David, his contract is an escalating nightmare of confusing clauses.
Yeah. So the actual value of the contract is 1 year, $2.5 million, with a $1 million club option for 2020.
That's peanuts.
Except in 2019, he can get to various performance bonuses based on games pitched. $25 million for each of the first 25, 30, 35.
I don't think you mean $25 million.
$0.25 million.
Thank you.
And then $0.35 million for each of 40, 45, 50, 55, and 70 games pitched. But he also gets $0.125 million for each 25 and 30 games finished, and then $0.25 for 35 and 40.
Okay, so making him the closer is literally a financial decision as well as a game decision.
Yeah, but the thing is, he was never going to be the closer on this team because that's not his role, and they have Ken Giles and then Tapera if Giles is traded. But the game started, or the games pitched, I think, is significant. But also, his 2020 salary is
Why stop in the first year, right?
Yeah. So the option increases to $3 million if he throws in 30 to 39 games this year, $5 million with 40 to 49, and $7 million with 50-plus. And then $8 million with 50 plus and 40 or more games finished. But that seems unlikely. So basically, the Blue Jays want his option to be worth $7 million.
I'm dizzy. I'll be honest. The contract rarely makes me dizzy, but that explanation was just a lot to take in.
Yeah. And I was just like, I was reading this off a page. If anyone was listening was like, I didn't follow any of that, I'm sorry, because that makes all the sense in the world to me. Go to Kotz contracts. It's, you know, Baseball Prospectus owns it now, but, and you can see the breakdown of this contract because it's bizarre. I can't remember seeing the Blue, I mean, it's not that crazy, but I've never seen the Blue Jays do it.
No, the Blue Jays have just started getting into incentive laden contracts, and I can imagine the negotiation for this contract was a weird series of conversations for both sides. Like, how about, and then someone throws in the idea of the game's finished. You know, that had to happen when someone's like, well, I want to squeeze a little bit more out of it. Well, we can't give any more for games pitched. Well, what if we finished games? You're not going to be finishing games. But what if I did?
Yeah.
Fine.
I mean, I guess this is sort of a necessity when you got someone who's coming off injury.
Yeah, I mean, it helps him build value. But it's almost one of those, like, well, what if he wins the American League Divisional Series MVP?
That's my favorite one. Batista had that in his contract.
They could invent it next year. Screw over some team.
I want to see that happen. I want to see Boras put that in some clause. Put that clause in some contract. It's like $10 million. He wins the division series MVP. The team's like, ah, sure, why not? And then he just like pushes the league and starts funneling money to the right people.
And then it works out. The odds of that seem excessively long, but it also seems like a Scott Boras kind of maneuver. Okay, I think is about all we can learn about David Phelps until he actually starts pitching in games and accumulating strange bonuses.
Yeah, and just regarding the escalating contracts and the incentives that the Jays are giving out in these deals now, I think part of it is just that they have more budget flexibility than they did under Anthopoulos.
Hmm. Could be a different...
I mean, he had to account for every dollar, right? So he couldn't afford to have a guy go and earn an extra $5 million beyond his contract, because then he was screwed.
Yeah, well, certainly the Jays are not in a tight payroll situation this year, as near as I can figure, or going into next year, unless some really strange stuff happens, as compared to what they've been doing the last, you know, 3-4 years. Okay, so we did have a bit of an article on Dalton Pompey by Ben Nicholson Smith. He talked to Dalton, and Dalton is, as you and I have recently discovered, 26 years old, which puts him right in Teoscar Hernandez, Bryce Harper territory. And he hasn't really had the success of either of those guys. Like, he would probably trade with Teoscar Hernandez in a heartbeat at this point. But he is still in the Blue Jays' plan, so much so that he and Atkins had a one-on-one.
Yeah, and interestingly, you should read the article. It's by Ben Nicholson Smith. It's on Sportsnet. If you just search for Dalton Pompey Life Coach, you'll find it, which is how we found it again for this podcast. You know, he talked about his goals for 2019 and how to reach those with Ross Atkins. And look, I mean, there's no sense in putting a lot of stock into this in terms of roster decisions, but it does make it at least somewhat plausible that we might be wrong about Dalton Pompey's standing in this organization. It seems like he's buried. You know, they've got McKinney, they've got Grichuk, they've got Teoscar Hernandez, Pilar, and I don't know if you want to include Jonathan Davis, who I'd rather have Pompey than Davis, but you know, there's a lot of guys like that. And it's just been assumed that the next 40-man spot that opens up, which we almost had with the Phelps and Martin thing, Pompey goes. But I don't know if that's true.
I think the only thing that we know is true is this is the make or break season for Dalton Pompey. I mean, you can't. I don't think he gets another crack at it if he's not healthy this year. He's clearly demonstrated that he can't be healthy. But if he's healthy and productive, I think you're right. I think that the team is ready to buy into him if he can be those two things.
Yeah, I mean, the talent that he had that made him, you know, a top 50 prospect in the game and excited people to the point where he was called up to be the starting center fielder at 22. It's still there. It's just he has to show that he can put it to work on the field and turn it into the skills that are required to hit upper level pitching and stay on the field.
Yeah. And the difficult part about baseball is you get old really, really quickly now. And
yep.
And Dalton is, for a prospect, is an old man, remarkably.
Still younger than Julie Merriweather, but he's out of options, which is going to make things a little more interesting. I don't know if a team would claim Pompey if he went through one on waivers. I mean, I think that you want him to stay healthy, right? Because if you trade him on waivers, you got to put him on your roster.
Yeah. And I mean, like you said, we haven't seen him stay healthy for a full season. That's one half of the equation. And then the other half of the equation is, will he produce?
Yeah.
I think it's cool that the Blue Jays are, you know, not shoving him in a closet somewhere, that they're willing to talk to him and that they're, you know, willing to obviously give him another shot at approaching this year in the best way possible.
Yeah.
Which I think speaks to sort of the thing that we were also going to, we had a question about was culture as it relates to an organization's, you know, approach and philosophy. And I'm sorry, did you actually have the question we got? Because I have.
Yeah, it's way too long to read on the air. This was, you know, when we do our Patreon stuff, the extra pellets, we ask our patrons what they'd like us to talk about. And George Vey, who we've actually discussed one of his topics before, he asked us to talk about this. It's not really a long enough conversation for an Extra Pellets episode, so we thought we'd do it here. Just this idea that the team might be focusing on specific aspects of culture that they didn't before. And he was asking specifically about competition, which with the catcher situation, and Ross Atkins saying that he wants Reese McGuire and Danny Jansen to be constantly passing each other on the depth chart. I don't know that that's new necessarily, though.
Well, we've certainly come a long way from what people classified as, you know, jerk ball, as we called it when Yunel Escobar was here and some other guys, where we seem to be taking... The organization seemed to be taking risks on cast-offs who had had conflicts with their organizations in of one way or another, whether personality or whether contract conflict or something else like that, thinking giving them a new home, ergo, say, Colby Rasmus, would cure them of some of their ills where they could blossom, you know, the change of scene kind of thing. We've come a long way from that because clearly the Blue Jays are not pursuing those kind of players at all anymore.
Yeah, I do think there's a different... potentially type of player they're looking for. I mean, when the Jays traded for Josh Donaldson and added Russell Martin and traded for Tulowitzki, it was all about, part of it was the leadership and the mentor that they could provide. But I think that Martin is still an example of that, more so than, say, the other two, just who tended to be more lead by example types based on their reputations. I mean, I think it was Shapiro, it might have been Atkins, Hammer, which of them even said essentially that Josh Donaldson's so advanced that he can't really teach other people his role. Which, obviously, that's kind of interesting. So then, but then you get like guys like Curtis Granderson, and they were going after CC Sabathia, these similar types of leaders, that these, you know, the old veterans who have been around the game. So I don't think that's such much of a change from the old regime.
Except now that we're looking at a team this year that appears to be completely bereft of older players, that, you know, the idea is almost that the kids learn from one another, I guess, or from the coaching staff more than from someone else on the field.
But Atkins even addressed this, though, on a radio hit, which we're going to discuss more about later. We got a question about it. He was talking about how they still have enough veteran leadership or presence. I can't remember the word he used. In this clubhouse with the, you know, he mentioned Kevin Pillar, which is interesting considering the reason he was demoted in his rookie season. But, you know, Kendrys Morales, Justin Smoke, these guys have been around, right? And Kendrys Morales is apparently a fantastic guy in the clubhouse by all reports.
Just not on the way to first base. Zing!
just to make this a shorter thing, I think that culture is something that this organization has valued from the beginning of this regime, but it also goes back to the end of the previous one.
Yeah, I think that they learned a lot about culture, and just because the two guys at the top changed, I don't think they forgot about how they need to manage the personalities on the team, young and old, as a function of what happens on the field, not just as what happens in the clubhouse. I think they do know that clearly shines through. It doesn't necessarily win you games, but I think it could lose you a lot of games if the guys hated one another for one reason or another.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So thank you once again, George, for the topic, because we did want to touch on that because it is kind of an interesting thing to watch develop. We're going to have an interview with Kyle Bodie coming right up after this. We're going to talk to him about throwing baseballs really hard and whether or not the Blue Jays will be doing more of that in the future. We'll be right back. And we are happy to be joined by Kyle Bodie, who is from Driveline Baseball, which is an organization that he is the founder of, who works with pitchers. And welcome to Artificial Turf Wars, Kyle.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
A pleasure. I'm glad you stopped by. So you're really kind of on the cutting edge of a bunch of things to do with baseball and pitching. So maybe for our listeners' benefit, just sort of go over what it is Driveline does as a service.
Yeah, I mean, the tagline is that we're just data-driven player development, and we're trying to bring, you know, just essentially the sabermetric movements of player development to bring quantified ways on how to actually get people better. So, like, why does someone how do you get someone throwing harder? How do you develop pitches and players? How do you rehab them from injury? How do you do a better job? And that's basically that's what we're just trying to do. You know, just trying to drive the limits of performance testing and injury rehab, everything you know, to its natural end.
So, how long ago did you start with that? You know, that process.
Oh, been working you know, for about 10 plus years now, but it's been a full time endeavor for only about half of that at this time. Yeah.
You know, a lot of the public facing stuff from what you do, especially when it comes to, you know, like Trevor Bauer is often talking about the stuff he's done with you, and is about not just spin and pitch development, but also velocity training. I mean, that seems to be, obviously there's a lot more to it, but specifically I wanted to ask, when it comes to helping people throw harder, how do you sort of marry that and mitigate the increased risks of injury that come with increased velocity? Now, without giving away trade secrets, obviously, but...
Yeah, and it just depends on who it is. You know, like a guy like Trevor has really low joint loads and kinetics for his throwing motion, so he can tolerate a lot more throwing. And we just do a lot of customized work here at Biomechanics Lab, run by our R&D team, like Joe Marsh and Anthony Brady, have the lion's share of the credit. Also, the athlete results team led by Sam Briand. We've driven the major injury rate in gym, and the people that train here, when we follow them for a year, down from like 4% down to below 1% over the past rolling 3-year average, which has been really great. And a lot of it is because customizing workloads and just getting better insights on the human body. And so for someone like Trevor, he can throw all the time because of his signature in biomechanics report. And then someone like Matt Boyd, a former Blue Jay, can't really throw all the time because he's actually considerably much better athlete than Trevor. So he has to have a much more customized and lighter throwing load to stay healthy. So it just depends on who they are and their signature in the lab.
So, I mean, how much testing is required to get to a point where you can sort of make those determinations about a player? Is that very quick analysis or does it take a while?
Yeah, you can get about 80 to 90% of it done within the first like a week that you work with a person. Our assessment process takes about 2 days, whether it's biomechanics, strength and conditioning, range of motion, pitch design type work. It just takes about 2 days. And from that, we can get about 80 to 90% of the value. So it's a service that we offer a lot of the major league teams, and that's we assess a lot of their athletes. So that's kind of what we do. And I know that's why a lot of our employees are being poached and moving on to other organizations. So I'm sure we'll get into that, but it's been a lot of fun.
Well, I presume you started out as an independent organization, like completely independent, and obviously you had an idea about how to do things better. But baseball is a very slow, or was, I should say, a very slow kind of impenetrable wall of old school ideas. How did you start? You know, where was your first in where you started convincing either players, or was it a specific team, that maybe you could actually, you know, get some real results that you could show them? Obviously, you're big on quantifying the results. Who was the first that said, oh, this is actually working and we can measure it?
Yeah, I was working with individuals. The first individual to train, the first pro individual to try what we were doing was Ryan Buchter, who now is in the big leagues with the A's. And it was great. You know, I always joke, the first two pro clients I had reached the big leagues, and it's been downhill since then, unfortunately. So it's been a 100% success rate was apparently unsustainable. So it was him and then Caleb Cotham, who is now the big assistant big league pitching coach with the Cincinnati Reds, but pitching the big leagues with the Yankees and the Reds. Then, yeah, there was those. And then Trevor Bauer was one of the first kind of active big leaguers who engaged with us in 2012, 2013. And that's been, that relationship's been going on. It's actually why I was late to this podcast. So I was talking to Trevor, so sorry about that. But yeah, that's kind of how it is. And then the first teams were I started working for the Houston Astros in 2013, kind of on the scouting side, not much on player development. I worked there for 2.5 years and then moved on to work for a couple other organizations doing player development consulting. And the first big one, I guess, is to answer the question directly, would probably be the Los Angeles Dodgers, which was 3 years ago in 2016. Working with a lot of the players and rolling out a weighted baseball program that exists today. And they call it the GAS program. And it's been really, really successful for them. It's been great.
That's really interesting. Now, when you started doing that, obviously you had this relationship with the Astros as an employee, but then the Dodgers as a client, did you find that there was pushback from other aspects of the industry, or was it sort of just everyone slowly caught on and weren't really aware at the beginning?
Oh no, it's just it's pushback every day, even today. Like it's not a smooth transition. You know, it looks like it from the outside, but no, it's just a constant battle, and you're just like constantly defeating one hurdle after the other. And then from the outside, it looks like a pretty smooth trajectory, but in reality, it's just like constant war. It's funny because a general manager once told me, he's like, "You don't have to be such a jerk on Twitter, like you've won the war." And I said, "That's what you think. Like, it's not true though. Like, we're constantly battling regressive coaches inside organizations and regressive college coaches. And like the simple fact is, the majority of players, the majority of coaches, like don't use our stuff. And so how could we have possibly won the war if that's true? So there's still a lot more work to be done to declare victory, I guess."
So you obviously want to pick up on stuff that you can point at and say, okay, you wanted me to get teach you how to throw harder. I taught you how to throw harder. You wanted me to, you know, reduce your stress on your body. I can show you how I'm reducing the stress on your body, et cetera, et cetera. It must be frustrating when you try and bring facts to the table and people just ignore you.
Of course. Yeah, no, it's just a great, wonderful, it's just wonderful. You know, you just have constant battles between facts versus opinions, and that just sums up baseball in general, you know, but it's pretty tough. The biggest thing is, like, you just got to do right by the players, you know. That's the biggest thing that's important to me. So when you have people like with the Toronto Blue Jays, the best prospects or one of the best, since you guys are loaded, being like a Nate Pearson, who trains here, and he'll actually be here in 4 days. And someone like Nate, like the Blue Jays have been great with him. You know, they drafted him, they knew what the situation was, and they've supported him, and he's been excellent for the Jays. But that doesn't always happen, unfortunately. And so then that's a tough situation if the player is in a regressive organization, and how you handle that can be pretty tough.
Now, given how important development is to the health of a franchise, is it somewhat surprising that trying to tackle it in this method has taken so long for even some organizations to accept?
For me, it is it's like pretty surprising, because like once this started getting a little bit of traction in 2013, I knew what the logical conclusion was going to be. I really did. I saw like the end of where player development's going to be, and we're not there yet. You know, we're 10 years away off, but I know where this is going. I know that like our organization is going to lead it, and it's weird to like know that and have the conviction and talk to GMs and AGMs who like just don't share that conviction, which is fine. You know, it's not their business. But at the end of the day, it is strange to not see like the level of buy-in is a lot lower organizationally than I would have expected, considering that like a lot of the players, the minor leaguers, the good minor leaguers are using it, depending on where you think Forrest Whitley is. If he's a top 5 prospect, whatever, you know, he's a player that uses weighted balls and has since he was in high school. To he'll be here with Pearson as well. And so it's kind of interesting to see. I think people are still fighting the tide. They're trying to. But as evidenced by the coaching hires, things are changing very rapidly. This year is going to be the first. I think this year will be remembered for a long time on how it changed baseball on the player development side.
Cool. So I will say that you mentioned the hires. I have two names, Dimitri Kokoris and Corey Popham. And I have no idea who these guys are or what they did for you. So as a Blue Jays fan and of a Blue Jays podcast, what is it that they're going to bring to the organization that maybe wasn't there before? Or what are they going to focus on that the Blue Jays were already, you know, starting to go into?
Yeah, and it's important to note that we have a really good relationship with the Blue Jays. It's been great. Obviously, there's a lot of ex-Indian front office members who we have a great relationship with Cleveland. So that's continued. But then down to people like Gil Kim, who's the farm director, has been a great contact with us for a long time, and it's been awesome. So, but as far as the coaches go, Dimitri is a friend of mine and has been since 2012. He worked here last summer as a part-time coach, and then Corey Popham actually trained under me when he was still playing college baseball, and then worked here as an intern for a summer, and then built his own place, and then was coaching college baseball. And what they'll bring is, it's a different perspective, you know, and that's what I think that's what Gil is looking for in a minor league coach. It's about challenging the surface, you know, just challenging kind of what's on the surface, challenging the status quo. That can be tough. You know, the first guy through the wall always gets bloody, as they say. So These guys are hopefully the right guys for it. I love both of them. Both, you know, if they wanted to, they're certainly welcome to work at Driveline. But of course, they're working for Toronto now. So I respect both of them. Yeah, both Dimitri and Corey were coaching college when they were hired. But yeah, they both worked here for a considerable length of time.
And I just sort of, when you mentioned they're going to be dying in the minors, trying to give a different voice. How much value, because obviously you work with current major leaguers, do you think that a role like theirs would have on a big league staff, given that, you know, the day-to-day is very different?
Yeah, it's very minimal, you know, but that's kind of not relevant anyway. You know, you don't really want to work. It doesn't matter for the big leaguers, for better or worse. You know, like a lot of them are going to be immutable. They're not going to change just because it's hard to change. You know, you're making big league money. It's your career. You spend your whole life dreaming of being in the big leagues, and then wanting to change is tough. Like, generally, people are only going to change when they face some sort of adversity, and that usually means being sent down to the minors or released. So trying to work on the big league side of it is kind of it's nice if you get it. Like, if Nate Pearson becomes a big leaguer fast, then I think that helps, because then you can point to someone like Nate and say, hey, this guy throws 100, but he can really pitch, and, like, he's, you know, his story is a good one. Left a major Division I program to go to a junior college solely because the junior college coach had a good plan for him. You know, Nate is definitely a guy that's very process-driven. So, like, that helps. It certainly helped in Los Angeles because their number one prospect was Walker Buehler, who's a trainee, you know, and Walker and I have a very good relationship. And then they had a bunch of organizational guys through the Driveline Dodgers Velocity program who were basically written off and then ended up becoming very good pitchers who ended up being traded this year and for real talent. And so as a result, you have, like, these organizational guys who aren't very good who get a lot better, and then you have your number one prospect who are, like, bookending it. So that's the best-case scenario. So the best-case scenario for the Blue Jays would be, like, Pearson reaches the big leagues either this year or next year, and then a bunch of organizational guys who are written off, like, develop fairly well under them. And then if that happens, it becomes really hard to ignore that, like, there's a better way to do this.
Cool. That sounds like you said, you see the future, and that's part of that future. I've noticed on Twitter, like to show off your new toys and your tools and your diagnostics. So why don't you give people the Twitter handles they might follow if they were interested in following along with these developments?
Yeah, we're at Driveline Bases on Twitter and then at Driveline Baseball on Instagram, where we post a lot about science we've been doing. It's been fun. We actually found some interesting stuff that we'll be posting in the next couple weeks about, like, the laminar flow, and not to bore all your listeners, but how the movement of the baseball, we'll be the first people to demonstrate that movement of a baseball is not completely understood, and did it in, like, a $200,000 science lab in the mountains of Utah. It was fun. So that's the kind of stuff that we tackle.
Sounds absolutely funky. All right. Thank you very much once again for joining us, Kyle. And hopefully we'll be talking to you maybe when Nate Pearson makes his major league debut and we need to get some insight into how he's doing all that.
That sounds great. He'll be throwing the hitters here on Monday. He's coming by. It'll be a blast. So hopefully I'll get to see him in the big leagues this year.
Awesome. Thanks again.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Bye-bye. And we have returned, as promised, as always. And since we have returned, we have looked at a list of things that we call your questions. And after that, I usually play this thing.
Time now to hear from our listeners.
That just seems silly.
Here are the rules. First, I ask a question, then you ask a question.
Now, how does that sound, sweetheart?
Could you repeat the question, please?
Are any of our questions actually repeat questions this week? Do they have a theme?
There are some people asking on a theme, yes.
All right. Hit me with question number one.
So the first one, let's just get this one out of the way. We're going to go a little out of order, but from Mike at Go Sense Go, Bryce.
Can we do his follow-up question?
Yeah, and then actually Bryce or Manny. And then Luke at Split Letters said, is there any good reason besides Rogers being cheap for the Jays not to go hard after Harper?
So I think what I would first like to add there is Bryce, because I don't know. He seems like better to me. Is that so wrong?
No, it's not. I mean, there's an argument to be made. I tend to fall on the same side, but he's also just a much better fit.
Yes. The fact that his shortstop third base position seemed to have some young up and comers in the Blue Jays system willing to possibly take them over for Machado versus the outfield, which is bereft of a center fielder that we would want to play every day. Yeah, that seems like a better fit to me, too.
I mean, Harper shouldn't really be in center, but he's an outfielder. The team's outfield depth chart isn't very good.
No.
And he hits left-handed.
Hey, that sounds cool. We should try that in the American League East.
No, there's no parks in the AL East that are good for left-handed batters.
Silly thought on my part. But we're back to Luke's question, though. Is there any good reason, besides Rogers being cheap, for the Jays to not go hard after Harper?
A good reason? I mean, I guess the reason that they would have is just that they don't want to throw money at, you know, lock up long-term money before they see where these guys are in the development curve, which I guess is a pretty good reason, but I don't think it's a good enough reason. I think they should absolutely be going hard after Harper.
Yeah, and I mean, I think as fans, it is not our duty to be good or bad with the team's money or consider their payroll, whatever's, because ultimately, as this topic is going to come up during the offseason, I'm sure, before we get to spring training, teams, all of them, are way too cheap right now because they are handing away a smaller and smaller portion of their revenue to the players, who are the reason that they have the revenue in the first place. So, you know what? No, there's no good reason. It's the same reason the Yankees, there's been a great discussion of this, just briefly, that the Yankees were trying to stay under the luxury tax of 189 so they could go and spend big this year. And although they haven't technically spent big yet, it's clear that they're not just throwing money around because the luxury tax is lower. They're just using it as a soft cap again. And it's getting a bit ridiculous.
But getting back to the Blue Jays specifically, I mean, you're talking about, like, it's not our job to worry about ownership and spending money. Even taking that into consideration, though, the Blue Jays have no real money on their books for next year. I mean, I think they have the only contract they have on their books next year is Tulo and Lourdes Gurriel. I think those are the only two guys.
Yeah.
And Lourdes Gurriel makes, like, you know, $3 million. So I there's a financial aspect to it that makes sense. Like, you could front load a deal to offset so that you have, you know, while you have lower costs with your prospects, you're paying more of Bryce's salary so that when you have rising other costs, his is mitigating it. But also, he's age-wise, he just fits in. He's younger than Teoscar Hernandez by a day, but still.
Even though he's like, he's so much more valuable than Teoscar Hernandez, then you should be paying him for that commensurate value, right?
Right.
And he's a good fit, like you said. All right, so that's the Bryce Manny theme, I think. So Brian has a good question at BJ Arsenal 84. Should the MLB allow aluminum bats in the home run derby? Imagine the distance on those home runs. And you'd probably have to take those little leaguers off the field since a line drive would probably knock one out.
Okay, second part first. Those kids should be off the field now.
They knock one another out.
But also, it's like, you know, those, I don't know how a ball hasn't given a kid a concussion. I mean, like, if a guy just tops one a little bit and hits a screaming liner into the outfield, like, those kids ain't catching it.
I think we're waiting for the one time when some, like, 13-and-a-half-year-old out there, like the oldest kid out there, parks himself by the fence and manages to rob a home run.
It did happen.
An actual up-over-the-fence home run robbery?
Yes.
Okay, then get him off the field.
The kid robbed one and they had to award the home run. That was a couple years ago.
I watched him a lot and I must have missed it. So that was probably somewhere in hour 3.5 of the home run derby where I had lost my focus because of the chip crumbs, you know, covering all of my body that I was trying to track down.
But to the first part of this question, no, they should not. They had one high school one a few years back. Jacob Gatewood was hitting 500-foot bombs with a metal bat. Major leaguers with metal bats would kill people in the stands. I mean, the balls would be getting in there so fast that it would be dangerous.
Yeah, this is a group of guys who can, with you know, a reasonable opportunity, hit the ball 120 miles an hour with a wood bat. That's a scary thing to add even 10 miles an hour to that, right?
It would be just so dangerous, and there's no point. I mean, they hit massive bombs with wood.
Yeah, they're doing fine with 20 or 30 in a couple rounds. It's like 30.
And also,
yeah,
Yeah, and also I think it would be less impressive even if it didn't hurt someone. It's like, yeah, okay, you hit 520-foot home run but with metal. You know, I'd much rather see 487 with a wood bat.
You just don't want to hear dink, dink.
No.
For like 3 hours. Hear that. The crack of the bat is where it's at. So Gideon Turk, our old friend, has posted a link to Ross Atkins' interview, and he said, what do you make of Atkins' comments the last few minutes of this shot on TSN radio about the upper minors pitching they've assembled and how one or two of them will develop into top of the rotation guys, and then also who has the best odds of doing that out of the bunch. Interesting that did Kyle say this before we actually turned the mic on, or did he say it after we did, that the Blue Jays are in fact loaded with talent?
I think that was on the radio. I think we got that on air.
Yeah, so that grabbed my attention because not everybody's the same point on the Blue Jays system in terms of how impressive it is, but Kyle didn't seem to be concerned at all with the amount of talent that they had amassed. So is there a real diamond in the rough here?
Well, first off, so just a quote. Atkins said, was talking about the upper minors depth especially, and he's saying it's like we've got 20 guys who are on AA or AAA who, you know, are of quality of some level. And that he thinks that, you know, a bunch of them will turn into mid rotation starters and two or three of them will turn into top of the rotation starters. I think that there is probably some, you know, playing fast and loose with the terms there, because, you know, the odds of any pitcher becoming a top of the rotation starter are not very good. So saying two or three out of a group are going to do it is, it's not likely.
Considering the Blue Jays currently have zero reliable top of the rotation starters.
Yeah. But, I mean, like Nate Pearson, who Kyle Bodie talked about, is obviously the number one and far and away best chance of anybody reaching that elite level ceiling. I mean, he throws 104, right? That's
and apparently knows a little bit about how to pitch.
Right. And, you know, if you can do that, you're a little step ahead of everybody else.
Well, you're Noah Syndergaard if that's who you really are, right?
Exactly. And, you know, it's staying healthy, which is Noah Syndergaard's problem too. But, you know, there are other guys who have upside. I mean, Sean Reed Foley has upside, and, you know, you could say that Hector Perez has upside, but, you know, I'd say that the odds are that none of the upper minors guys is going to reach that highest level other than maybe Pearson. I mean, you could say lower guys like Pardinho or Abe Klopfenstein even, but that's because they haven't had enough time to show whether they can or can't do it.
So you think he's pumping the tires on his own organization maybe a little bit?
Well, like I said, I just think he's just, you know, his top of the rotation guy might be
like his impact bat from last year.
Oh, let's not go into that. But yeah, I mean, he might be saying, like, you know, what they've gotten out of Marcus Stroman to this point in his career. I would not call that a top of the rotation pitcher, but that might be his definition.
Yeah, it's not. It wouldn't be an unfair way to use that term. But it wouldn't be the way we might use that term in our day-to-day discussion. There's no Felix Hernandez waiting in the wings here in the upper minors.
No.
Now, do you think, though, that he is talking reasonably about maybe finding a couple, if he believes that there's that many guys, about finding one or two diamonds in the rough in terms of finding someone with the consistency of a Marcus Stroman who through development gets better? I mean,
absolutely, there could be that. And some of the guys I've added, like Trent Thornton, they seem extremely high on. The guy they got for Aledmys Diaz, who apparently has this extremely high spin curveball and a good fastball. And, you know, Julian Merriweather had, you know, he was a 26-year-old before getting Tommy John surgery and was still appearing on prospect lists, which doesn't even happen when you're 26. So there's guys with stuff. And there's guys who could develop stuff. So it could happen.
I just want to clarify for everyone. Did both guys and stuff have a capital in that sentence?
No, just stuff.
Just stuff? So they were just guys, not guys. But they had
stuff. I really got to stop using these terms. But, no, but there are pitchers who have elite level stuff, or at least some aspect of it that seems like if it's honed, it could be really good. Like David Paulino, for example, who they also got for Osuna. You know, there's talent, but there's also a lot of risk.
Fair enough. All right. So we haven't been nearly silly enough this podcast, I don't think. So it's probably time to we are out of questions, right? I read over them all.
No, we're not. We got two more.
Yeah. I did not refresh One must refresh the window, Greg. Oh, there it is. Noel! Noel Moxon at the Mox Ball. First question. Who's traded next? That's a weird question. Not Russell Martin. No. Okay, who's the oldest guy? Is it Kevin Pillar or Justin Smoke?
It's Morales, and I don't think...
Nope.
I'd say the next guy to get traded is a pitcher. I don't know who, but a pitcher of some kind.
I'm going to go out on
Ken Giles or...
I'm going to say it's Marcus Stroman.
Okay.
For cultural...
I think it's a good bet.
For cultural reasons, like it, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, even without that, but like if you said who's the next guy to get traded and it's going to be during the season, it's going to be Ken Giles and Stroman, I think, are the two far and away leaders.
Fair enough. And Noah was big on the questions once he saw the tweet. He asked, who is your favorite player incoming this year to make the greatest impact not named Vlad? One pitcher and position player, or maybe just one of each between us? I don't know.
Sure, you go first.
Incoming this year, that's a tough call because I don't know who really will be incoming this year. I like Ryan Borucki, I think. I'd like to see a full year out of him. I wouldn't say I'm excited, but that would be interesting. And probably Danny Jansen.
Yeah, I mean, those are, I think, probably the best. But since you, I'll stick with Jansen because I'm right there with you on him. And I will say Brandon Drury.
Yeah, well, somebody's got to man third base until May 1st, right? Or what?
But I think he's good, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, he'll play second once, you know, because Travis is not looking like much right now. But I think Brandon Drury is a very good player. I wanted the Blue Jays to trade for Brandon Drury last year, and I was upset when he went to the Yankees. So I think he's a decent player. I just thought it was weird that they traded for him because he didn't fit the roster. But, you know, I think people will be pleasantly surprised with him.
Cool. All right.
Those now we can be silly.
Okay, absolutely. So James G at James and T.O., who also provided the audio for the Russell Martin clip earlier. I failed to give credit on there. So thank you, James, for recording that for posterity for us. He came up with a bot. I don't know where he got this idea, but it is certainly one of the stranger bot ideas I've ever had, that if you tweet it at his account with the appropriate hashtag...
No, it wasn't even a hashtag. Oh, you just wrote just My Blue Jays.
My Blue Jays, sorry.
With spaces and everything.
It will tweet back at you two randomly selected, one pitcher, one catcher, Blue Jays seasons.
Pitcher and hitter.
Did I say pitcher and catcher? My God. yeah, sorry. Pitcher and hitter, Blue Jays seasons for you to peruse that can be yours and yours alone. I don't know what it means, really, but
they are you. You are represented by these seasons.
I am clearly identified now forever by Dave Steeb's 1988, a year in which he was 16-8 with a 3.04 ERA and threw 207 innings with 8 complete games, his most complete games in the late 80s after his, you know, his real high point. And 1998, Carlos Delgado... a year in which saw him, 620 plate appearances. Carlos was busy. He only hit .292, .385 with 38 home runs, 115 batted in, one triple.
I didn't know we were going to go on this in depth. So I ended up with 1987 Jimmy Key, which that was Key's best season by far. Led the league in ERA, threw 260 innings.
Got no love from anybody other than the Toronto people.
He did finish second in Cy Young voting.
Oh, he did that year. Okay, fair enough.
Yeah, yeah. Jimmy Key was my first ever favorite player, so this was kind of fun for me.
I must admit that of all the players, of all the veterans, I should say, on the World Series winning teams, Jimmy Key was my favorite pitcher by far, way by far. I was so sad when Jimmy Key left. So I'm right there with you. Who's your...
So I got 1998, like second or third tour, depending on you count. Third tour of duty, Tony Fernandez, which, you know, was a good year. He came back and was like the third baseman who would fall down on pitches that were nowhere near him, but pretend they hit him. And yeah, he hit 320, 387 on base and a .459 slugging.
I
want to talk about...
Tony was amazing in just the fact that he kept coming back, reinvented Tony Fernandez, and it was like... I don't even understand how you're back in Toronto, but sure, let's go for it again. The Tony Fernandez go round was a strange thing.
It really was. But Well, you're talking about you were sad when Key left, right?
Yes.
My favorite Blue Jay at the time in 1992 was Jimmy Key. My favorite non-Blue Jay was David Cohn.
Wow, that
And then
worked.
They traded for David Cohn. And then they both left in the offseason.
Truly, 1993 was a high point for you in so many ways.
Yeah. And then 1994 was the ultimate low point because there was the strike and then 1-2 in Cy Young voting were Cohn and Key on the Royals and the Yankees, respectively.
Yeah. That's definitely a dark hour for you. I'm surprised you didn't quit. It was like it tore your heart out. TurfBot also has a...
They got theirs as well. We got ours, I should say. 2009 Roy Halladay, which how do we not get it? We got to get a Halladay, right?
Yes, absolutely.
And 87 Fernandez. The reason I wanted to mention this specifically is because the TurfBot scored higher in the Baseball Reference War than either of we did, which makes sense.
Yeah, well, it's like the sum is the whole is greater than the sum of its parts, clearly.
Yeah. It's not really greater than the sum, but it's the whole is just better than us individually.
I 100% agree with that. I walk around during the day and I'm like, you know, this would be better if Josh was here to explain it.
And for me, this would be way better if Greg were here to tell me what to talk about.
All right. Enough with the lovin'. I think we have come to the end of another Artificial Turf Wars podcast. So that is to say that you were Josh Howsam at Joshua Howsam. I was Greg Wazewski at Coolhead 2010. Our guest was Kyle Bodie at Driveline Bases. And this has been Artificial Turf Wars episode number 127. And we'll talk at you in a couple weeks.